the studio with me today, I have Christopher Petrella, who teaches at Bates College and explores questions about the intersection of race, criminality, and citizenship. His work has been featured in the New York Times, Harper's Magazine, Boston Review, and The New Yorker. His research has appeared on ESPN and NPR and has been debated in the U.S. House of Representatives. Great to have you here today.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So tell me about this U.S. House of Representatives debate. It's very interesting that what you're doing has made it all the way over there.
Yeah, a few years ago, in 2013, 2014, one of my colleagues and I were working on questions of prison privatization. And it turns out that there's a very deep amount of secrecy and lack of transparency when it comes to private prison companies in the United States. And so we endeavored to help Representative Sheila Jackson Lee out of Houston, a Democrat, draft a bill that would require private prison companies like CoreCivic and the GEO Group, which are these monstrosities of publicly traded for-profit prison companies, to disclose the very same information that their public counterpart agencies already have to disclose. So in simpler terms, if you're a journalist and you want to access information about the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, you can file a FOIA request, and if it's reasonable, you'll be able to obtain that information. If you try to find similar information on publicly held private prisons, you can't. They generally claim a proprietary exemption clause and say that the disclosure of such information would generally put them at a competitive market disadvantage. And so we, among many other people, found this particularly problematic, of course, since we as private citizens ultimately pay for private prison companies to exist to a large degree. And so the act was called the Private Prison Information Act. It was introduced in 2014, 2015. And it hasn't made it out of committee. My understanding is that it will be reintroduced very, very shortly. So we're looking forward to hopefully some fruitful results from that debate.
This seems like a very specific field that you've chosen to go into. I know that you have degrees from Bates College, Harvard University, University of California, Berkeley. What sent you down this path, and what was your educational background?
Yeah, I'm very much generally interested in questions of justice and how we can expand the we of an evolving democracy. My family and I lived in the Hartford area until I was about four, at which point we moved to this tiny sort of bucolic rural community called Summers, which is in north central Connecticut. Summers has more prisons than stoplights. So I grew up in a town with three prisons, which included the maximum security facility. At the time, it also included death row. Connecticut has since gotten rid of capital punishment. And so questions of carcerality, questions of containment, punishment were in my backyard. And that generally served as an entree into beginning to ask questions about the relationship between race and democracy, or sort of more capaciously, race, democracy, and incarceration. I discovered as a fairly young person, I think I was around 16 when the 2000 U.S. Census came out, and discovered that somewhere between 12 to 15% of my community was what the U.S. Census would classify as Black and or African American, despite the fact that I went to school with very few Black peers. So this raised some questions, right? Where are these folks being counted and why? And so with the help of a progressive teacher, we looked into this matter. And he helped me to understand that for the purposes of census designation, resource allocation, sometimes legislative apportionment, prisoners are counted in the census tract in which the facility is located, as opposed to from where they came. And that struck me as particularly problematic for a whole host of reasons. It sort of perverts the democratic process. I later came to understand this as prison gerrymandering, which is an official practice that a lot of states utilize. And what it essentially does is resegregate particular communities and then in conjunction redistributes wealth. I knew that being a white family in this particular space, where in many ways we were benefiting directly and complicit with these prisons housing many black and brown folk in my community, called me to think through what that complicity looked like, right? And began to ask questions, well, what does it mean to be white in the United States? And I've sort of carried those questions with me since.
It's a complicated conversation, and I think it's one that not everybody feels comfortable having.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Questions of race, it seems as though we've kind of in some ways come very far, and in other ways it may be stalled out to a pretty significant degree. How do you get comfortable as a self-identified white male talking about these really sticky issues?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I'll ever be comfortable. I think I'm very much a work in progress, but I would say it begins with the recognition that maybe we don't know as much as we thought we knew about who we are. And I say we as white folk. James Baldwin has a fantastic quote from the mid-60s in which he writes, white people are trapped in a history they don't understand. And I think that's very much an accurate diagnosis of the American dilemma. When did, you know, a question I often ask my students, my white students, self-identified white students, is when did you know you were white, right? And that process of becoming white, that process of American socialization as white, is one that's complex and one that means different things to different people. I began to explore that through the prison question, which in a lot of ways is why I think it's impossible to ask questions about what punishment looks like in this country without thinking through questions of race, without thinking through questions of democracy, especially because, quite frankly, the prison system in the United States, or more accurately, prison systems, came up with the birth of the Republic, right? They were cousins, and so if we're going to diagnose questions of power, questions of access, questions of freedom in democracy, it would be incomplete not to include questions of punishment.
I'm trying to remember this quote, which I probably won't be able to, that has something to do with, if you want to understand a society, then you need to understand its prisons, essentially.
Yeah, Dostoevsky.
Yes. Yep. So, and I think that's really true, because I don't want to call it the lowest common denominator, but there is something about the way you treat people who have gone against what society considers to be moral and legal that really reflects back on the society itself.
That's right. And I think there's also some slippage sometimes between what's moral and what's legal, of course. And I'm reminded by one of Dr. King's famous quotes, which is, an unjust law is no law at all. And I think in a lot of ways that's relevant to where we're at today.
How do students that you teach respond? I know that Bates actually has a history of trying to be as inclusive as possible over the decades. But it still has a fairly high percentage, I believe, of white students, as do all the small liberal arts and university schools in our state. Mm-hmm. So how do people respond that you are teaching now?
I think generally the response has been fairly favorable. I think if you meet, and I think this is sort of a general pedagogical good practice, when you're meeting students where they are with where you are, it's very difficult to have an inauthentic encounter and conversation. And so I try to open myself up to being uncomfortable. I mean, we, you know, in every syllabus that I construct, there's always a line that suggests we're trying to make a safer space for dangerous conversations. And if we can't have those dangerous conversations, I don't actually know that we're particularly capable of moving the needle forward on these seemingly intractable social issues. But I would say that Bates's genealogy, I think, makes the institution very favorable to having these conversations, both at the classroom level and at the institutional level. Something that not everyone, many people know that Bates was founded by Orrin Cheney, who was a Free Will Baptist abolitionist. What folks don't know is that he was great friends with Frederick Douglass. I mean, he was right in the mix. He was right in the thick of it. There were, you know, several instances in which Frederick Douglass came to Maine to visit with Cheney. Here in Portland, in fact, Douglass spoke at least twice that I know. When City Hall used to be in Monument Square, he made a few stops there. He also made a stop or two up to Lewiston and Bates. So the institution, the state of Maine, in a lot of ways has a very rich history and legacy vis-a-vis abolition. Of course, it doesn't mean that the state is where it needs to be, but I certainly think we can draw on those histories to influence the present.
Having now had one child who's graduated from college and another who's currently in school, one of the things that I'm very aware of is this kind of culture of microaggressions and this culture of, well, I think you kind of addressed it, that mm-hmm. of fear around even having a conversation, because mm-hmm. if you say something that's outside of what might be considered politically correct, you're really putting yourself at risk. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to a place of conversation? And how do we get to a place of conversation without having people feel threatened?
Mm. This is a complicated question. I think it depends who you are, and it depends on one's embodied identity. So I can only speak as a white person what that means to me. I would say it means approaching questions of potential sort of racial tension, or just more generally tension related to social power, with a certain radical openness. And particularly if we can't have these conversations at our institutional, at our educational institutions, then I'm not quite sure where we can have them. But microaggressions are certainly, I think, an issue on every college campus around the country. And in part of my role at Bates, over the next 4 to 5 months, we're actually putting together an anti-bias bystander intervention training program, hopefully to equip students better to intervene in real time in these type of incidents, which thankfully are paltry, but nonetheless problematic. So we're looking at ways for students to build literacies when it comes to identifying incidents of bias, intervening in incidents of bias, caring for oneself and the target in the aftermath of an incident of bias. And then more generally, from a higher altitude perspective, living one's principles, right? So how do we sort of transmogrify a lot of the values we have into direct action, into political engagement, into community conversation and dialogue? And I think that's an evolving process. So we're certainly happy with what we have in store in terms of our palette of offerings. But you're right, it's a thorny issue and one that needs to be addressed around the country.
As a white male, have you ever experienced kind of, I guess, reverse bias?
No, I have not.
Well, you're fortunate.
Yeah, I would say that, so my PhD is in African American studies, more precisely African diaspora studies from UC Berkeley. And I would say I was one of maybe three or four white students in that PhD program. There was not a single time that I felt unwelcome. There were times that I felt intellectually and politically challenged. But again, I think that's the recipe for evolution and growth anyway. My sense has always been almost all people of color that I ever encountered, when they know a white person is deeply invested in the cause and has proven themselves to be a co-conspirator over many years, one will welcome you with an open hand. That's generally been my experience. So,
it also seems the way you're describing it, as if it comes from the way that you frame it as well, where what you just talked about was that you have felt challenged, but you didn't feel as if it was a bias against you.
No, not at all, because I think once you recognize all of the accumulated privileges that you've had, that I've had, despite growing up in a working class family, I think sometimes the issue with white people is that we think that privilege is absolute, right? So the common argument is, yeah, I'm white, but I grew up in a working class household. Yeah, well, yeah, that you have racial privilege and you don't have economic privilege, and that's okay. It doesn't invalidate the fact that race is still a salient organizing principle in society, and we need to contend that. So I think in some senses you're very right to say that it's a matter of framing. And it's a matter of having enough sort of historical literacy and historical sense to understand the problem correctly. I'm also lucky because through a lot of my research and work, I've been able to meet other staunchly anti-racist white people who I can look to as an example. There aren't many, I will say. And some days are obviously harder than other to find those examples, but they are out there. They certainly are out there, and there are a whole host of folk. So John Brown, Howard Zinn. I mean, I could go on, but.
Well, what's your criteria for a staunchly anti-racist white person?
I think the most important ingredient is someone who has a structural or systemic analysis of white supremacy, which is to say that racism is not exclusively transactional, right? It's not necessarily fully based in discrimination, but is based in how we choose to organize society, right? So I think perhaps a powerful example could be one of the first pieces of legislation that was passed after the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, which was the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1790. And the act expressly prohibited non-white people from naturalizing as U.S. citizens, right? That's something we have to contend with. But I think that because in most circles, this history hasn't been exhumed. We don't always have, as white folk, we don't always have the best analysis of how deep white supremacy goes in our history, in our politics, in our policies. Until a piece of legislation was passed in 1952, there was still a racial restriction on immigration. My dad was born in 1952. I mean, that's recent history. I could go on and on, but there are many examples that bring this history very much up to the present, right? I mean, there is a groundswell of evidence to suggest, particularly in the U.S. South, that the origin of municipal police departments were in slave patrols, right? So having that type of historical literacy, I think, forces a different analysis and forces a different confrontation. So
I'm finding this also interesting because obviously as a medical doctor, my background was educationally more science-based. Mm-hmm. I did have history classes, but they were far fewer than the ones you had and far less extensive, obviously, given your educational background. However, my daughter is a history major. And
that's awesome.
Yes, of course. And that's actually something that I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit too. And that is we talk about the value of education and how do you quantify it? You know, mm-hmm. if you go out and you're a doctor, obviously there's a job for you on the other side. Mm-hmm. If you're a history major, then mm-hmm. there's a few different paths you can go, but it seems like it's less certain. But what you're describing is extremely important mm-hmm. to have people who actually understand the background mm-hmm. of our culture and society. So when you were deciding to get your PhD, what did that calculation look like for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I've never been my calculus and calculation has never particularly been sort of economistic. I have to say, I very much think there are sort of differences between vocations and professions, and I'm lucky that I was able to sort of meet at the intersection of those two fields. My thinking as a person in their mid-20s when I started the PhD program was that, quite simply, we needed more white people who understood their history. And if we begin with that proposition and sort of build a critical mass, I think we certainly can sort of move the ball forward. But I'm very fortunate. I mean, I'll also say that good people doing good work find each other. That's always been my experience, and so I feel fortunate that I've been able to link up with other folks doing the work. So I just got back on Sunday from doing a Know Your Rights training camp in Chicago at the DuSable Museum, which is the Museum for African American History, which was fully sponsored by Colin Kaepernick, the former quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. So that's the sort of work I'm talking about. I think they're real people doing real work, and it's inspiring to be a part of those conversations and hopefully a part of the solution.
So what you're saying to potential history majors out there and current history majors is do what feels important to you and don't necessarily assume that there won't be a job on the other side.
Yeah, I think I'll say this. I think my sort of vocational orientation has always come from the words of this educator, Howard Thurman, who wrote, do what makes you come alive because the world needs people to come alive. I think we need to be awake and vigilant and conscious and conscientious in order to improve our collective lot. So my sense is if you're doing what you're doing pretty well, hopefully over time, there will be opportunities for you. And if you don't like what you're doing, you're not going to do it well. So, you know, I think there are certainly calculations that some people will make that are different than mine. You know, I'm a staunch supporter of the humanities, a staunch supporter of interdisciplinary programs. You know, I've been very disappointed to know that many of these programs, disciplines, are on the chopping block. I don't think it's particularly where we need to go as a society. I think we're losing opportunities to ask questions that matter very deeply. And that's also, I'd want to be super clear, that's not to suggest that the natural sciences do not matter, because I think very much so in my field. There are connections that can be made between the natural sciences and questions of power. In fact, if it weren't for the sciences, it's possible to argue that white supremacy in its current form would not have survived through Reconstruction. It was scientific racism that allowed white supremacy to propel itself forward in the postbellum period. So I think all of these questions and themes can get taken up in a variety of ways that are not necessarily exclusive to the humanities or interdisc programs. I think good work can be done everywhere.
What is it about the work that you've done that has gotten ESPN interested in you?
It's generally The Undefeated, which is an outfit of ESPN, a web outfit of ESPN, had a couple of quotes a couple months ago, and it was through my involvement with Colin Kaepernick.
It seems as though there's a lot of different ways that your career could go. I mean, you're relatively young teacher, I would say.
Yeah, I got a couple grays that have sprouted over the last few years. So
yeah, well, you know, I think that a lots of education can sometimes that do that to a person.
Very much so.
Yes. What do you hope to see happen? What do you hope to see happen over the trajectory of your career and really of the field that you're working in?
Two separate questions. I've always felt like the traditional academic route was not particularly tailor-made for someone like me. I love writing. I love being able to give talks around the country. But I'm aware of the limitations of, for instance, publishing exclusively in academic journals, speaking to, other folk who use the same language and have the same units of analysis and in the same discipline. And so I'm sure that in some way, shape, or form, my career will be one characterized by hybridization. So I very much plan to remain in the academy in some capacity. I think that's an important grounding. I do think theory is important. I do think scholarship's important. My question is always, who's seeing it? Who is able to access it? And are we as scholars and academics making ourselves clear and relevant? And I think this is part of sort of my working class genealogy bubbling over the surface here, because if I couldn't understand something, it wasn't relevant to me. Not to harp too much on Dr. King, but he also, later in his life, in the late 60s, said, if you can't understand something I've said, it's a failure of my education, not yours. And I think as academics, it's incumbent upon us to make sure we are adding to the conversation, not alienating and marginalizing people who may not have the same pedigree, who may not have the same sort of life experiences and, quite frankly, privileges and opportunities. Having said that, I very much want to make sure that I also have one foot that is either outside of the academy or able to pivot sort of in agile ways. And so, it really has been a pleasure linking up with the Know Your Rights initiative, because it's provided an opportunity to bring some of this sort of rigorous scholarly work to a community that's just vastly underserved by their institutions. And so I see that in a lot of ways as sort of a way to sort of redistribute knowledge. And I think that's generally been a guiding principle. So how can we ensure that people, all people, have access to the sort of knowledge sources and various literacies that I, as an instructor at Bates, with a PhD, have. If we can do that, then I think we're onto something. To your question about where I'd like to see the discipline and the field go, I very much would like to see, and I think we're getting there, but I would very much like to see more self-identified white people investing themselves of questions of not only race, but really just questions of sort of critical social literacies, power, politics. I think that's what we sorely need. So for instance, you know, in I think we need more self-identified white folk to be asking questions like, well, you know, should we vote for the Democrat or should we vote for the Republican, as opposed to, can we think about how both of these parties, in a lot of ways, have their roots in whiteness and have their roots in white supremacy? Abraham Lincoln did not think that black people and white people were equal by any stretch of the imagination. He articulated that very proudly, actually, in one of the early Lincoln-Douglas debates, I think in 1857. And, you know, the Democratic Party has its roots in the KKK, in the Dixiecrat South. So I think we need more white folk to shift the conversation. I think we need new frameworks, new, better questions. That's where I'd really like to see sort of generally the field go, and also just education more generally. So I know that not every course can engage questions of race in the way that I'm describing, but I think every course certainly can engage questions of power. If we're not doing that, then I think we are offering our young people an incomplete education.
Well, I appreciate the work that you are doing, and I hope that what you have asked for will materialize over the course of the next few years to years and years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we plan on making that so.
Excellent. So. I've been speaking with Christopher Petrella, who teaches at Bates College and explores questions about the intersection of race, criminality, and citizenship. Thank you so much for all you do and for coming in today.
Thank you so much.